This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
And in Jerusalem, Israel, we have Brent Noctegal.
Good to be with you.
In the last couple of weeks, there have been at least four rocket attacks in Iraq by Iran-backed forces, and the latest one on Wednesday resulted in the death of an American citizen. To tell us about this, we'll go to Brent.
Yeah, on Wednesday morning, there were 10 rockets that struck the Al-Assad base in western Iraq. This is the Anbar province region, one of the only locations that U.S. forces are still, one of three locations where the U.S. forces are still operating inside Iraq, the other being the in Erbil, which is in Kurdistan, northern Iraq, and then around Baghdad. And this during this barrage, there was an American contractor that was embedded with U.S. forces that suffered from a cardiac arrest during the actual barrage while taking shelter with American forces. And then shortly thereafter, perhaps immediately after, it's hard to get a true reading of the events from the spokespeople of the Biden administration. But shortly thereafter, he died. And so while you do have many spokespeople, even Joe Biden, saying that nobody was killed in the rocket attack, we do see that somebody died during that rocket attack. And definitely it was a stress-induced heart attack by this attack on American forces. Now, what is interesting about this is, and as I bring out in this piece that I've just written on the Trumpet right now, the American forces inside Iraq are very vulnerable to rocket attacks from the Iranian-backed Shiite militias. These are militias that answer directly to Iran. They're Iraqi, but they answer to Iran. The weapons that were used in this case, the 122-millimeter rockets, the way that they were fired off a movable transport, hidden tray of a truck, and then how they were fired, these are the hallmarks of Shiite militias that answer to Iran with Iranian weapons. And so we know it was the Iranians that were behind this. Now, this type of rocket attack, it's very hard for the United States to stop those from landing on the bases. They don't have an Iron Dome system like the Israelis have that can hit mortars or even these type of rockets out of the sky like you see fired from the Gaza Strip by Hamas, other Iranian-backed proxies. And so what you have in this case, as in similar cases, you have American soldiers that are told to seek shelter incoming. They do some type of anti-defense or defense maneuvers, or they let something go into the sky to try and stop the rockets from hitting the targets, but they're not effective. And so you've got Americans that are sitting ducks right now inside Iraq, and the Iranians are attacking them. And it's hard to see what the Biden administration is going to do about it.
So the mullahs' fingerprints are clearly all over these attacks. The U.S. Presence there is incredibly vulnerable to them. What's the goal of Iran here?
Iran has been thinking long-term in Iraq for ever since the revolution in 1979. There was the goal to take over Iraq, to bring it into the Iranian sphere. Of course, you have the two variants of Islam, Sunni and Shia, two main ones. Iraq is 70%, I think it's Shia Islam, or maybe even a bit more than that. And Iran is, Iran would claim to hold the authority in Shia Islam as well, with the Grand Ayatollah, who's the leader of Iran. And so you've always had an attempt by Iran to remove the Sunni powers, be that Saddam Hussein, or be that a lot of the other interim governments that the United States has tried to set up inside Iraq. And so the long war that Iran has faced for this past 40 years against Iraq has been ongoing. And Qasem Soleimani, the now deceased former general of the Iranians that Trump killed with an airstrike, he used to lead up this effort to empower militias on the ground in Iraq that answered to Iran with Iranian weapons, Iranian intelligence, and then tell them to go and fight against American forces. So this has been the strategy for about 20 years since America has been there. And the great goal now is not just to take over Iraq, but to get American forces out. And so following this attack, we did see a couple of statements from Kataib Hezbollah, who are most likely the proxy that are behind these attacks, that, again, answer to Iran, saying that we're not going to stop until American forces are gone. So that is definitely the goal. And unless the United States changes its modus operandi of proportional response, meaning, again, you hit me over the face, I hit you over the face, and then we're done. Let's settle back down. It's hard to see how what the game plan would be for the Americans to stay in Iraq, because they are going to consistently, with that type of response, Iran is not going to be deterred from acting, as we saw from this. Again, on February 25th, we had that so-called big strike against Iranian assets. This was in Syria, but it was in response to another attack that the Iranian militias had against Americans back mid-February. And this was meant to show Iran and tell Iran, send around a message, you will pay. Shiite militias will pay for attacks on the U.S. bases. Well, 2 weeks later, here is Iran doing it again. And this time an American soldier was killed. And so America has yet to respond. I don't see any other way for America to stay there and think that its troops are going to be protected. And so we are possibly looking to a drawdown of forces there from America.
So Iran's pushing for the complete withdrawal of U.S. forces, and you're saying that it's likely to happen. And here at the Trumpet, we've actually been expecting that very thing.
Yes, this is one of the landmark prophecies of Mr. Gerald Flurry that he said going back, I think 1994 is when he had the first article, Is Iraq Going to Fall to Iran? And he really did double down on that when America invaded. He said that even though the United States has 100,000 soldiers in Iraq right now, we expect Iran to take over Iraq. And that was due to a prophecy found in Daniel 11, verse 40, which talks about a radical king of the South that pushes the world towards war. And Mr. Flurry has forecast that Iran is the leader of that king of the South, and that we're going to see Iranian belligerence increase. And that for Iran to maintain the power that it needs to push to greater areas in the Middle East and then to push at Europe eventually, as prophecy says it will, it really does need to ensure that it controls the massively oil-rich state of Iraq. And so to ensure that it is not fighting against Iraq and then trying to go elsewhere. It's in Shia doctrine that the road to Jerusalem, which is one of the targets of Iran eventually, runs through Karbala, which is one of the holy sites inside Iraq. And this was one of the mottos of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps that Qasem Soleimani headed up. And so this is one of their initial goals, before they spread their wings, really, across the Middle East, and that is to take Iraq. American forces have been a hindrance to that. Bible prophecy says that America is no longer going to stand in the way in Iraq.
We'll leave a link in our show notes to Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry's booklet, The King of the South, which explains the prophetic context of everything that we're seeing happen in the Middle East there. And then Brent also has an article up at thetrumpet.com right now. As he mentioned, it's called American Contractor Killed in Iran-backed Rocket Attack in Iraq. So please check out the show notes for today's episode to see links to those. Thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll stay with the topic of Iraq and take a look at a visit the Pope is now making there that he's branding as a pilgrimage of peace. For this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, just a few hours ago now, the Pope landed in Baghdad, in Iraq, for this historic trip. Iraq has been the only place of strong biblical significance that has never been visited by a pope. So he arrived at the airport there. He was met by the Iraqi prime minister. They rolled out the red carpet for him, and they had a choir and a big welcoming ceremony. And then he left into Baghdad, where they've there was, you know, lines of people there ready to receive him. He will be traveling south to visit the place that the Catholic Church says is the homeland of Abraham. I think it doesn't match the Bible's description. But anyway, it's the one that's commonly accepted as being Ur of the Chaldees, the place where Abraham is from. And he'll kind of have this meeting of religious authorities from different religious groups, because, of course, Christians, Muslims, and Jews all trace their, all revere Abraham. And so he's making a kind of a big push for peace there. He will also be visiting Mosul on this trip, which was one of the a big Christian center in Iraq. Before then, it was taken over by Islamic State. He will be meeting with Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, one of the biggest figures in Shia Islam. He'll be having a 40-minute meeting with him. And really, at least in terms of what they've put out ahead of this trip, it seems like he's got the two main things that they're emphasizing. The first, like you said in the introduction there, is he's a pilgrim for peace. He's coming here to work to try and bring peace to Iraq, this war-torn country that has seen a lot of violence over the last few decades, and then also to draw attention to the plight of Iraq's Christians. They've gone down from about 1.4 million to just 250,000 over the last few years. That it's been a massive, massive hit to the Christian population there. One of the other key places for his visit will be a Syriac Catholic church in Baghdad that was attacked in 2010. The attack killed over 50 people. And so he's going to be drawing attention to the persecuted Christians in Iraq. And I think already, even ahead of the trip, you can see this bringing a lot of publicity to them and Christians across the Middle East.
So he says he's there as a pilgrim of peace. He's there to ask God for forgiveness for the violence in the region and just to bless the wounded land, as his statement ahead of time said. But what can you tell us about the deeper motivation here?
Yeah, I think there is so much here that is really interesting to watch. I mean, and Brent set this up in great context, I think, with how crucial controlling Iraq is for Iran. And Europe knows that. And the Pope, I think, knows that as well. And so perhaps part of this visit is an attempt to see if he can pry Iraq away from Iran. It's not something that he'll succeed in. But sitting down and meeting with Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, there are some people, and Crux, for example, a Catholic magazine, are talking about how it's kind of an attempt to build him up at the expense of the Iranian supreme leader Ali Khamenei as kind of the leader of the Shiites, and potentially an attempt to swing Iraq away from the Iranian influence. And it makes sense. I mean, you, Jeremiah, had an article a few years ago that I stumbled across while looking up this subject on the Trumpet website, talking about the Pope visiting Lebanon, the same Pope, and talking about how, you know, Europe's making this, Europe is pushing forward these efforts in the Middle East. They want to create a network, an alliance of countries that are opposed to Iran, that his visit to Lebanon was an attempt to swing Lebanon out of the Iranian orbit. And so you could see what he's trying to do in Iraq as something falling into the same type of initiative. But I mean, regardless of that, just the Pope getting more involved in the Middle East, the Pope taking this country that has been so much the focus of the United States and the United States' responsibility, a responsibility the United States would love to get rid of, but to see him coming in there, and that ties right in with these Bible prophecies that we've been expecting of the Catholic Church playing a much bigger role in the Middle East, the Catholic Church playing a bigger role as a peacemaker in the Middle East, or somebody you go to negotiate for peace. And then the way that he's been highlighting as well the persecution of Christians. For years, we've been talking about watch for the Catholic Church to start to do this more as well.
Any literature you would point listeners to if they'd like to understand that context?
Yes, I mean, the King of the South booklet is a great place to see this context, because you have to see this in context of this kind of clash of civilizations, this this battle between radical Islam led by Iran, and in Bible prophecy that's referred to as the King of the South, and then it's European power dominated by Germany and also by the Catholic Church, that in that the passage in Daniel chapter 11 is called the King of the North. And there are other passages that you can put side by side with that that show that this King of the North, they make alliances with other powers within the Middle East. They confront Iran by building bases across the Middle East. And then really, I mean, there is so much packed into Daniel chapter 11, and the King of the South, like I said, just unpacks all of that. But even that whole passage talks about the way that the Pope is eventually going to move the seat of his authority over to Jerusalem. The papacy in this prophecy is very focused on what is going on in the Middle East. They're very engaged. So by getting more involved on this issue with persecuted Christians, you can see that bringing the Catholic Church and Europe much more into conflict with radical Islam. And then you can see at the same time this peacemaking role paving the way for the role that the Bible says that they will have in Jerusalem, where they appear as a peacemaker to get more involved in the negotiations that are going on around Jerusalem and the peace process there, something that paves the way for the Catholic Church to be able to gain the dominance of Jerusalem. So this ties in with so many essential Bible prophecies, and that book will really explain those prophecies to you.
We'll be sure to include a link to the King of the South in the show notes there. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, it's been some time since North Korea has dominated headlines for its illegal weapons programs. Things have been mostly quiet around the 38th parallel, but a new report this week signals that that could be about to change. For this, we'll go to Mihailo Zekic.
Yeah, thank you. As you have mentioned, it's been a while since North Korea has been in the news. As a lot of our listeners may remember, the last time that the threat of a nuclear North Korea has been particularly cycling through the news was about 4 years ago or so, when Kim Jong-un was boasting about North Korea's upgraded nuclear program and threatening to annihilate American cities with recently developed intercontinental ballistic missile technology. The United States President Donald Trump at the time stated that he'd respond with fire and fury against North Korea. There was a lot of rhetoric going back and forth, and eventually the two have decided to have a reset and calm things down for a bit. While the relationship between Washington and Pyongyang wasn't particularly friendly for the rest of the Trump presidency, the nuclear threat with North Korea seemed to have been calmed down, at least to an extent. But that is changing at the moment. In January, Kim Jong-un boasted publicly about increasing his country's nuclear power. And just this month, a new report came out showing photographs from the 38 North website, which is a organization that specializes in North Korea studies, and showed satellite imagery of North Korea's Yongbyon nuclear complex being in operation. Now, this is especially significant considering Yongbyon actually hasn't been in operation for about 2 years now. This is only satellite imagery, so there hasn't been any official statements from the North Korean government, so we don't know exactly what's going on. They could be recycling nuclear waste, which the facility is capable of doing. But given Mr. Kim's recent boasts about upgrading his nuclear program and his track record, it's pretty one can only assume that he's preparing to start ramping up nuclear material production. The laboratory is specifically a facility where plutonium is extracted through reusing nuclear fuel rods from reactors and reprocessing them to collect plutonium, which is also which is combined with enriched uranium, one of two ingredients needed to make a nuclear bomb.
So what can you tell us about why things were quieter with North Korea under the Trump administration, and why the North is choosing this moment now to possibly return to a more provocative posture?
The main reason was President Trump, unlike some other U.S. presidents, actually threatened with military force to end the nuclear program. You see a lot of other presidents like President Obama, President Clinton, talking about securing a nuclear deal with North Korea to stop the program, or talking about sanctions or diplomatic rhetoric or that kind of thing. President Trump, this was early in his presidency, and he was claiming more of a warlike footing, and that probably was the initial reason why Kim decided to back down a little bit. And also the other big reason, we don't know, of course, the details for sure, what was happening behind the closed doors, but President Trump's trade war with China would have been another reason why North Korea probably decided to back down. The trade war between America and China was hitting the Chinese economy pretty hard, and a lot of people suspect Chinese President Xi Jinping, who is Kim Jong-un's main sponsor, probably had a few talks with him to calm down the warpath rhetoric in an attempt to appease the president. But now we have a new administration in Washington, one who, of course, Joe Biden is the former Vice President Obama. He was part of the government during the tenuous days of the Obama presidency, when North Korea was able to get away with a lot more nuclear activity. And like Iran, who has been causing a lot of problems lately with their nuclear program, Kim Jong-un might be trying to test the waters and see what he can get away with.
Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and let the listeners know what they could read to understand it in that context?
Of course. Not too long ago, a few decades ago, you basically, multiple countries had nuclear weapons, but the two main ones were, of course, the United States and the Soviet Union. Smaller countries like Britain and France, they didn't really have too much push. But now we see also after the end of the Cold War, we see all sorts of countries with nuclear weapons and flaunting them. Countries like China and India have greatly expanded the nuclear program, and little North Korea, what used to be a communist puppet state that didn't have too much relevancy in the global world order, they have nuclear arsenal. People don't know exactly how much. In 2018, a South Korean politician said they could have from 20 up to 100. And they're quickly developing the capacity to strike American cities, even all the way across the ocean. The Bible doesn't say that North Korea is going to start nuclear World War III. However, with all this nuclear proliferation going around, with all sorts of countries just with their own ambitions in their own power blocks getting pushier and pushier with nuclear weapons, it's hastening to the time that the Bible calls in Matthew chapter 24 the Great Tribulation. In verse 22, the Moffat translation says that if this Great Tribulation wasn't stopped, not a single soul would be saved alive. And while, again, North Korea won't be the main instigator of this conflict, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has a lot to say about the North Korean threat. He wrote in his free booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, a lot about North Korea. And he quoted Charles Krauthammer, quote, "North Korea's regime is bizarre in the extreme, a hermit kingdom run by a weird, utterly ruthless and highly erratic God King. You can't count on Caligula. The regime is savage and cult-like. Its people, robotic," unquote. And Mr. Fleury basically outlines on how you have a country like this that has control of nuclear weapons. That's been a problem in and of itself. But when you see all the other countries in the world that have nuclear weapons or are trying to get them, you can see that nuclear war is a lot closer than a lot of people would like to hope or think. And once it happens, the pivotal prophecy in Matthew 24 is going to be fulfilled in a major way.
Well, thanks very much for that, Mihailo. We will leave a link to Mr. Fleury's booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, in the show notes. For the next story, we'll take a look at the way hackers around the world are seeking and finding ways to black out the internet, disrupt supply chains, and just sow whatever cyber chaos they can. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's an interesting report released on Axios on HBO this week. It was by Kevin Mandia, who's the CEO of the cybersecurity company FireEye. That company was actually the first company to detect the SolarWinds hack that had been occurring in the United States for 9 months before it was detected. And they were the ones that found out about it, let the world know about it. So the guy's got some credentials, and definitely when he says something, he's got some of the experience to back it up. But this report he was saying this week, as he was talking about that, he said any future conflict between the United States and an adversary like Russia or China or some other nation will likely involve a debilitating cyber attack. This is like the future of warfare. His quote says, the next conflict where the gloves come off in cyber, the American citizen will be dragged into it, whether they want to be or not. Apps won't work. Appliances won't work. People don't even know the things they depend on. All of a sudden, the supply chains get disrupted because the computers don't work. And so this is a pretty sobering form of asymmetrical warfare he's talking about here, where he's talking about like similar with that SolarWinds hack, where you've got like malware being used in the U.S. government and even in the nuclear security agencies and in private companies, and I think even some of the other attacks are like into like the critical infrastructure, like the electrical grid, where he's talking about like shutting down the internet, shutting down power companies to where, like I said, your computer doesn't work, the apps on your phone don't work if you shut down the Apple or Google servers that empower those apps, and to where you basically even the supply chains don't work, and then like the whole country can't communicate with each other. So that's
pretty terrifying to hear, you know, just how vulnerable so many of the technologies that we depend on are. So you wrote an article about this week. It's called Cyber War is Imminent. And I think you made a powerful point in there about the tendency of generals to fight with whatever the main tactics of the previous war were, rather than those of the present war. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, that is a well-known saying that generals always fight the last war, just for the reason that, like, when military strategists are studying how to fight wars, they study the recent history, the current tactics. And so, like, I think one of the big examples they throw out in, like, World War I, a lot, like France especially, but a lot of the Allies became experts, no, I'm sorry, World War II, they became experts in World War I style trench warfare.
Right.
And to that figure, it's like, all right, well, we're confident that no one's going to be able to beat us in the trenches this time around. But then with the Blitzkrieg warfare strategy, all that tactics, all that maneuvering kind of became irrelevant. And you will see that today as well, to where the U.S. military, I mean, with their aircraft carrier groups and their tank battalions and the tactics they used in the surge in Iraq, they're considered like head and shoulders above every other nation in terms of conventional warfare tactics. But the question becomes is, like, as this man brings out, is like, will the next war be fought with conventional warfare tactics? He had another quote in that report from this week where he says, there are no written documents on what the rules are, and we don't know how to get people to agree on what the rules of espionage are, because the asymmetry where most countries can't beat us with tanks, can't beat us with airplanes, but in cyber, that's maybe where they can make investments and beat us. And just making the point that he's like, so the playing field is definitely much more level in the cyber warfare realm than it is in the conventional warfare realms. Nations that can never beat us with tanks or chips are looking into ways that, like I said, you can shut down the computer systems. I think one example I pointed to in that article is that, and this wasn't a cyber attack, but like last year or 2 years ago, there's a power outage in Silicon Valley where like Google went down for an hour, and like Gmail didn't work, Google calendars didn't work, all the like spreadsheet, Google Docs and spreadsheets that companies use to communicate with this didn't work. And they said if you could do something like that with a cyber attack, it could really paralyze a nation, which is something that our editor-in-chief has been talking about for longer than most people, where Mr. Gerald Flory, the first time he mentioned it was in 1995, where he talked about computer dependence being America's Achilles heel, and pointing to a prophecy in Ezekiel 7 where it says, the trumpet's blown even to make ready, but none goes to battle, for my wrath is upon the multitude thereof. So this is a prophecy applying to the United States in the end time about like an alarm or a trumpet of war being sound and none going to battle. And then he's pointing in that article that said that could well be a cyber attack that takes down military communications systems. Something like what that Axios report was talking about this week. They said you get the right cyber combination, and like I said, they not only the communication systems go down, but even like the supply chains and other things go down. And now they're even we've talked about this on this program before. They're even talking about the potential of like cyber warfare in elections, where you hack a voting machine and pick a candidate. So it's like all forms of just like asymmetrical warfare that could be used against the United States to fulfill that prophecy in Ezekiel.
Mr. Fleury has a book called Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. He also has an article called America's Achilles Heel and Germany. We'll link to both of those in the show notes. And then Andrew also has an article up at thetrumpet.com right now. It's called Cyber War is Imminent. So please check out all of those in the show notes for today's episode. Thanks very much, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up, we'll talk about the latest on the Khashoggi murder report, tensions between the U.S. and Germany, China infiltrating universities in the U.K., and the Biden administration's nominee for Attorney General. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke last week about the Biden administration accusing Saudi Arabia's crown prince of murder. Well, this week, more details emerged showing just how flimsy the evidence behind that accusation was. For this story, we'll go back to Brent.
Yeah, this is about the declassified report from the Office of Director of National Intelligence, which did seek to implicate the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, in the killing of the writer Jamal Khashoggi back in 2018. We won't go through that killing. It's been talked about and discussed at length. And what the big question was who was to blame? Now, there was a report that was put out in 2018, a CIA report that was very similar to the unclassified report that was just released this week. And there are numerous articles out to show that, as you said from the very beginning, the proof that bin Salman was actually behind a killing or was intent, this was premeditated murder of Khashoggi, was absolutely not proven in the document itself. This is how Lee Smith says it, or at least Lee Smith is an author that's written quite a lot about the Obama deep state. And he said this, quoting the ODNI report, this was the central claim, quote, although Saudi officials had pre-planned an unspecified operation against Khashoggi, the assessment reads, we do not know how far in advance Saudi officials decided to harm him. Meaning that this is what was more likely was that they were trying to bring him in. They were trying to kidnap him. He was not necessarily just a writer of the Washington Post. He only wrote a few articles. But as Lee Smith brings out, he's not a good writer. His English isn't that well good. Most of his articles were written by other people funded by the Qatari government, who is an anti-Saudi Arabian government. They're against the Saudis. He was also a Osama bin Laden friend. He was against bin Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, because he wasn't Islamist enough. And he had very close ties to some former agents in the Saudi government inside the intelligence industry there. And so they were trying to bring him in because he was sowing dissent against the Saudis amongst the Obama people. And what numerous articles have brought out, including one by Eli Lake in Tablet, he interviewed somebody that was the senior director for Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council in 2018, Trump's government. This is the person inside Trump's government. And as she said, this report back in 2018 and now what was released in 2021 was an abuse of the intelligence community's power, meaning that they are feigning that they had proof that the Crown Prince was behind this, a killing, a premeditated killing, in order to discredit the leadership of bin Salman. Mohammed bin Salman is a moderate. He's trying to bring Saudi Arabia away from strict religious rule. He's the one that allows women to drive. He's the one that allows women in Saudi Arabia to travel internationally without a male escort. These are things that the West should be celebrating. But instead, what a lot of these priests bring out is that Mohammed bin Salman is a great threat to Barack Obama and Biden, the Biden administration's foreign policy goals in the Middle East. As the prime adversary of Iran in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, the Biden administration is hoping that Saudi Arabia is gives Iran more of a pass. Bin Salman does not want to do that. Now, there was another prince that was being groomed to be the crown prince and who was the crown prince up until 2017. And he was being groomed by the CIA. He was being groomed by American officials. He was not as strong on Iran as Mohammed bin Salman is. And so ever since he was removed from being the crown prince, and this MBS, as he's known, is now the crown prince, the Obama administration and now the Biden administration have sought to get rid of him. And this is a smear campaign to accomplish that.
So this U.S. report stands to seriously undermine America's relationship with Saudi Arabia. And now we see that it's based largely on surmise at best and possibly even fabrication. What's Saudi Arabia's response to this?
Saudi Arabia is caught in between a rock and a hard place. It needs the United States for many reasons. It needs the security alliance. And so, you know, there is some trepidation there. Does Mohammed bin Salman apologize further, kind of go back into the background a little bit for and hope that there's a new return to President Trump in 4 years or something like that? Or does he recognize that this administration is going to swing hard for Iran and that there is no point trying to placate the Americans in softening his approach to Iran? I think there's plenty of indication that that is the route that Saudi Arabia is going to go. The UAE, Oman, Egypt, a lot of the others came out in support of Saudi Arabia. These are all American allies, but they recognize what's happening. And perhaps the relationships that President Trump has nurtured between the Gulf states, the anti-Iranian states, and Israel is strong enough now that you will see greater distance between the United States and them, but maybe the Saudis are recognizing that we can perhaps go it alone without the full support of the Biden administration. Now, Bible prophecy indicates that America's relationship with Saudi Arabia is not going to be the most important relationship it has with an outside power. That is going to be taken by Europe. Europe is going to come in, and this is based off Psalm 83, a prophecy of an end-time alliance that really counters what Iran is doing. And Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Turkey, Jordan, a lot of these states are involved in that alliance, and that America isn't leading that. It's actually Europe. So perhaps we'll see a greater push now for Saudi Arabia to search out European help as America shows itself to be so closely aligned with Iran.
And what literature would you recommend for listeners who would like to understand more about that in the prophetic context?
People can read our trend article. It's entitled An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe.
We'll be sure to leave a link to that in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, we've seen a lot of disturbing cooperation over the years between Russia and Germany. It's a trend that we've called attention to many times because of the disastrous effects that often has led to for other nations. And this week, news broke that Germany is letting Russia develop chemical weapons on German soil. For this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, on Tuesday, the Biden administration unveiled some more sanctions targeting Russia. And one of the remarkable things on this list of sanctions was three German companies, which I don't think they're particularly massive German companies, but three German companies sanctioned because They're enabling Russia's chemical weapons program. So this is Vladimir Putin's covert program supervised by the intelligence agency. And these three German companies provide precursor materials and technical support that then go towards chemical weapons manufacturing in Russia. In a lot of ways, this story is remarkable because Germany has kicked up a lot of a fuss over Russia's chemical weapons activities, especially about its poisoning or attempted poisoning of Alexei Navalny. He was taken into Germany, treated by German doctors. There was a lot of German rhetoric. Very little German action, though, in the wake of that. And now what the sanctions demonstrate or announce is that Germany was at the very least turning a blind eye to or be complacently allowing German companies to aid that weapons program. And at worst, actively helping Russia develop these deadly chemical weapons.
So I alluded a little bit to the pattern of dangerous cooperation between Germany and Russia that we've seen over the years. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something Trump editor-in-chief covered. We had a big front-page article from him several years ago called Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. And this article focused on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which I think if you listen to the show regularly, this comes up a lot. This is this pipeline where the two countries are working together to increase the dominance both of them have over Europe's oil and or Europe's gas supply. And there's a lot that you can do with that dominance. I think what this story shows that this isn't kind of a one-off, or this isn't just Germany doing something because they're really desperate for natural gas or something like that. This really does prove that there's a deeper relationship here. And I bring up that article because Mr. Flurry really gets into what's behind that deeper relationship. That, again, this is not just coincidence or business or anything like that, but actually there's a boiling resentment within both countries for this kind of international order that's led by the United States. And the point he makes in that country is they're not necessarily best of friends, that this alliance, neither of them really trust the other, both kind of fear the other to a certain extent. That's another angle that we cover a fair bit. But there's a seething resentment in both countries, and they're working against the United States. And I think that resentment is much more on display in Russia than it is, to say, the casual observer within Germany. But you dig a little deeper and you see stories like this. You see it as well in opinion polls that we talk about, where Germans say, they talk about, well, we should be neutral when it comes to this disagreement between China and the United States, as if one country that's locking millions of its own citizens in concentration camps and another trying to end that is something that should be neutral about. You see it in other polls that show that Germans were more afraid of, say, President Trump than they were Vladimir Putin. But this story exposes that relationship, and that article from Mr. Gerald Flurry just does a great job of describing that relationship and how this resentment against America, how dangerous that is, and how that was prophesied in the Bible.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. We will leave a link to Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America in the show notes for today's program. For our next story, we'll take a look at the way China is using universities in the United Kingdom to further its nuclear weapons program. For this, we'll turn it back over to Mihailo.
Thanks. The Daily Telegraph came out on the first of this month with an exclusive of how much China has been courting both British universities and British researchers at those universities to work for its nuclear weapons program. China has basically only one major nuclear research laboratory in the country. It's known by the innocuous name as the Chinese Academy of Engineering Physics, or the CAEP. And a lot of these, British universities and researchers there have a lot of connections with there. And these aren't just like smaller no-name universities here and there. These are like researchers from Cambridge University, the University of Edinburgh, a lot of really like high profile institutes of higher education in the country. And I'm not claiming that Britain is secretly collaborating with China to build nuclear weapons, but a lot of this might be done unwittingly through Chinese grants and scholarship opportunities and that sort of thing. But it is a pretty significant venture that they're going. A lot of these scientists have connections with Archer, the UK's national supercomputer, or its particle accelerator, Diamond Light Source. A lot of these researchers work for the government themselves, and it's basically the latest example, and a pretty serious one, of China taking advantage of the West's technology to be able to further its own economic and military development.
What can you tell us about how broad the scope of this Chinese infiltration is? And is it limited to just their nuclear program, or are there also implications for other aspects of the People's Liberation Army?
Oh, totally. This is not just restricted to their nuclear program. A Civitas report, Civitas is a UK think tank, published a report where they said, quote, "There is a pervasive presence of Chinese military-linked conglomerates and universities in the sponsorship of high-technology research centers in many leading UK universities and in the research relationships," unquote. They've been able to make inroads in a lot of Cambridge is a particularly important place where they've been targeting researchers, and a lot of sponsorship and joint university projects joint projects between the UK and China include the development of things such as drone development, shipbuilding, radar, AI, robotics, mellows and alloys. It's pretty serious. And in fact, Imperial College London especially has been implicated by the Civitas report. There has been at least four research centers at the university that are sponsored by Chinese weapon suppliers and developers, including the Chinese affiliate that's developing China's stealth fighter jets with their aviations program. Which is intriguing considering the particular research center that in Imperial College London specializes in that kind of technology. And there's other things like radar absorbing material for fighters and carbon fiber reinforced plastic and other things like that. It's pretty like Manchester University is another one, Birmingham University. A lot of these universities cooperate with China in directly or indirectly through their military program.
Where would you point listeners who would like to understand this in the context of Bible prophecy?
Our free book, Russia and China and Prophecy, has a chapter called What the China Miracle Means. That would be a very important chapter to in the regards of the rise of China. A few decades ago, China basically had little to none major influence in the world. It was it had a huge population, but it was mired in infighting and disastrous communist policies. And China since then has ballooned into a superpower that has really taken the world by storm. And this is there are a lot of details in that booklet on how China did that, like how in 2008, it actually overtook Britain as the world's second largest military defense spender, and lately, hijacking British technology and research expertise has been a big part of that. But the big reason we're watching China is because the Book of Revelation describes a power block in chapter 16, verse 12, as the kings of the East, and we expect China to be part of that conglomerate. East in this case refers to east of the Holy Land, and we're talking about kings, so powerful countries. And in Revelation 9:16, it mentions that this army of the kings of the East will have a 200 million man army. You go east of the Holy Land, look for like important power players, and you get countries like China or Japan, Russia, India, that have these massive armies and a massive population to draw armies from. And this latest infiltration by China in British universities is demonstrative of how much China seriously takes its military program and how it's looking to equip it with the latest and the best for its military goals.
We will link to Russia and China and Prophecy in our show notes. And Mihailo also has an article that he's working on about this that should go online next week sometime. So please keep an eye out for that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much for filling us in on that, Mihailo. For our final story of the show today, we'll take a look at the situation here in the U.S. where Merrick Garland is very close to being confirmed as the new attorney general. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Yeah, as you said, America is about to have a new attorney general. Merrick Garland was approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee in a 15-7 vote on Monday and is expected to be confirmed by the full Senate within days. Our listeners will remember Merrick Garland. He was actually Barack Obama's choice to fill Antonin Scalia's seat on the Supreme Court.
Right.
And then was not confirmed by the Senate until President Trump took office, and they put Neil Gorsuch in that spot instead. But this this attorney general confirmation basically brings him back to the legal scene, not as a Supreme Court justice, but as the head of the Justice Department, which will be an interesting development to watch. In his Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, he made a huge point about how there's no equal justice in America. He said this, speaking to Senator Cory Booker, he said, "Senator, there's no question to me that there is disparate treatment in our justice system." And then he focused mostly on inequalities in the amongst minorities in the prison system and in the housing system. But he's making a mistake many leftists make about confusing equal outcome with equal opportunity, because with the affirmative action system, like in housing and things like that, there's already a curve put in there for minorities to be able to get access to those things more easily than the population at large. And so we've got an article up on the website by Mr. Stephen Fleury titled "Garland Confirmation Exposes Unequal Justice in America" that really goes through a lot of the prophecies in the Bible, especially in Micah, about how there is extremely unequal justice in the end times. Some of them even got even using like the metaphor of cannibalism to suppose like how some of these judges are treating the people, but in a very different way from what Garland is talking about actually giving giving some of these rioters and some of these looters and criminals and other people in the American system even more rights than the people they're victimizing.
As Andrew said, we have an article up at thetrumpet.com right now by executive editor Mr. Stephen Fleury. It's called "Garland Confirmation Exposes Unequal Justice in America." And we will also include a link in our show notes to Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, Micah, God's People Rise Up as His Enemy, which really gives some big picture context for this. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. While we are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour, please email any questions or comments you may have about today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, and Brent Nachtigall. And we'll leave you today with these words from Nolan Bushnell. "Everyone who's ever taken a shower has had an idea. It's the person who gets out of the shower, dries off, and does something about it who makes a difference." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.